Thank you for joining us. My name is Katie Heinle, and this is the Fisheries Podcast, a weekly podcast that shares the stories of the amazing people and projects that make up fisheries science. If you haven't already, follow the podcast on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod. If you're the generous sort, you can be like Ben, Tyler, Janet, Robin, and John, who all support the podcast on Patreon. Through Patreon, you can support the show with either a recurring or one-time donation, which helps us pay for various parts of the show. If that isn't your thing, you can also purchase Fisheries Pod shirts, hoodies, stickers, and face masks on our Teespring store. Today, I'm interviewing Carmen Ritter. Carmen received her Bachelor of Science in Computer Science at Vanderbilt University in 2018. However, she took a leave of absence from Vanderbilt in 2016 to participate in a semester study abroad program, which led her to shift her career trajectory from computer science to ocean conservation. In 2017, she was awarded a National Science Foundation Research Experience for Undergrads, or RU, internship to work with the Sarasota Dolphin Research Program at Moat Marine Laboratory. Currently, Carmen is a staff biological technician for the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center, where she works on coastal marine ecosystems. Welcome to the podcast, Carmen.
Thanks for having me.
All right. I like to start with people's background. So where did you first develop your interest in the ocean and fisheries?
I would say it started when I was very young. I grew up going to Virginia Beach a lot with my family and loved collecting horseshoe crabs, and I called them little periwinkle shells, but the coastal burrowing bivalves that you can dig up right after the wave comes through, and all kinds of critters, anything I could find on the beach, I would corral them up and have other children come look at my zoo.
That's awesome. So you started out as a computer science major at Vanderbilt, but then you took this leave of absence with the semester program. Can you tell us about that experience and how it shaped your career trajectory to date?
Yeah, so I basically should have realized much earlier on that marine science was my passion and computer science was more of something that seemed like a good choice. I had always been good at math and science, and I knew that computer science was a pretty good career choice. It was a pretty easy way to get a job, make some money, and I did think it was cool, but I hated it a lot. It was a long 4 years. I did stick it out, but taking that leave of absence was the best choice I think I've ever made. It just reconnected me with a lot of things that have fascinated me for my entire life and that I love so much. And I was happier working crazy hours on watch shifts and cleaning things and cooking for 20 crew members than I had been any point in my Vanderbilt classes.
So with the semester program, it was a couple of months and you did this transatlantic trip, right?
Yeah. So semester is a program that takes college-age students aboard as officially signed on crew members. I was on a 112-foot schooner named Argo and only spent one night off of her for around 3 months, and took a couple of classes in oceanography, marine biology, and got several certifications, you know, including my advanced open water diving certification, my VHF radio operator, and other random little things like that, like navigation master, lots through international yacht training. Certification program.
Awesome. That sounds like such a cool program.
Should I talk about where we went?
Yeah.
So I boarded Argo in Nice, France, just off the coast, and we traveled the Mediterranean, so Southern Europe, Northern Africa, and then we went to the Canary Islands and left for a transatlantic voyage from there. And that took us, I think, 20 days. So about 3 weeks aboard the boat, no land in sight. And we made landfall in Dominica in the Southern Caribbean and kind of traversed our way up the island chain to Antigua, where we went home in time for Christmas that winter. But I think I was one of the only people who could have stayed on there.
Yeah.
Another 3 weeks and a lot longer than that by the end of it. Everyone else was pretty miserable.
Yeah.
But that definitely told me something about myself.
Yeah, for sure. And then the next summer is where we met at Moat Marine Lab, where we were both NSFRU interns. So can you tell me about the projects and research you did during that internship?
Yeah, so my project at Moat was with Dr. Katie McHugh, And it focused on acoustics or bioacoustics and trying to develop an algorithm to detect bottlenose dolphin whistles in acoustic recording. We had hydrophones in different places around Sarasota Bay, and I would do some visual observations and make sure they matched with what we were hearing on the recordings. But I also worked with David Mann at Loggerhead Instruments a whole lot to try and write some code that would detect the frequencies and pitches of the dolphin whistles when they occurred so that someone, a sad intern like myself, would not have to listen to, I think, oh, something like 48, maybe closer to 60 hours of audio recordings. And most of them, you're just hearing snapping shrimp constantly that'll drive a person crazy. And then the occasional toad fish will kind of, you can hear him pop his head out and start making some weird noises.
That's awesome. So your computer science background really helped with that then.
I do think that is why I got the position, but that was not my favorite part of the job. I got to go out and do prey sampling just via scenes with them a lot. And that was really fun getting to pull up all kinds of salty fish that I don't get to see where I am right now. And just see the area from the water too is always a great perspective to have. We also would go out a whole lot to do visual IDs. So we used FinBase to identify local dolphins that were known to the team there in Sarasota and keep an eye on them, track them through their lives, their social groups, and everything.
That's awesome. I can definitely see the field work being way more rewarding than computer science aspect, although both are important.
Yeah, I was tucked away and what they told me would be the ideal quiet environment to listen to these audio recordings, but that turned out to basically be a storage closet that had no windows. And I had my chunky headphones on for hours at a time and had to have a watch so that I knew when it was time to go home because, again, no windows and that door stayed closed. Good times, really developing some character there.
Oh, for sure. Honestly, my favorite part about being at that internship was just meeting all of you. I feel like I got such great friends out of that. I was so happy just to attend the internship, if only for meeting all of you guys.
Oh my gosh, no kidding. Yeah, I haven't had an experience like that at any position, like where it was just like instantaneous. We spent the whole summer together. Like we didn't hate each other secretly.
No. Worked out great for us.
So good.
So then you went back, you graduated, and you started an internship with your current employer, which is the Smithsonian Environmental Research Center. To start, what work did you do for that internship?
So I started with the same two PIs that I work with currently, kind of split between their two labs, which is actually my exact position now as a fully employed staff member with grant funding. So those were the Fisheries Conservation Lab, which at the time was the Fish and Invertebrate Ecology Lab. FishCon is led by Matthew Ogburn, and I also work for Marine Geo or the Marine Global Earth Observatory, led by Emmett Duffy. Marine Geo is a team of scientists from the Smithsonian and our network of global partners who are working together to take the pulse of the world's oceans with the long-term goal of building diversity for resilient coasts. We just want to understand how marine biodiversity can work to maintain functioning ecosystems in the ocean for the benefit of both animals and people.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it is cool. So my internship project was hauntingly similar to my moat internship. It was to watch dozens and dozens of hours of video footage this time. At least I got some video connection there. But many hours of videos of reef fish going after and taking bites out of standardized assays, basically, different macrophyte types and freeze-dried squid, and marking down every time something took a bite, identifying that fish, and how long after the video had begun that bite event occurred. So definitely another extremely tedious task to be handed off to an intern. But thankfully, I've gotten a bit more out of that one.
Yeah. So you've now transitioned to this full-time biological technician. This is probably a terrible question for you, but what's a typical day-to-day look like for you?
I must say that is a terrible question.
Yeah.
There is no day-to-day. Every day is different and presents its own excitements and challenges. I am in one of two places. I am out on the water or I am in the lab, because very rarely do I get to actually sit at a computer and get anything done. But when we're in the field, we have all kinds of long-term projects and shorter-term grant-funded projects that we're working on in the Chesapeake Bay for the Fisheries Conservation Lab primarily. And for marine geo-related work, I have currently a National Science Foundation grant to study coastal eelgrass beds on the west coast of North America. And so I am processing samples under a microscope a whole lot of the time for that when I do get to be in the lab, which is primarily over the winter since we're seasonally driven here.
That's awesome. And you do get to travel quite a bit, is my impression anyways of your job. So I'm assuming part of that's for the eelgrass, but what's one of your favorite projects that you've traveled for?
The Smithsonian Scientific Diving Program training is often done at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, which is in Bocas del Toro, Panama, a series of islands off the coast of Panama. And although that wasn't for a specific project, it was really, really nice to get to go there, to see that lab, to talk to the scientists who work down there, and to just dive a lot. That was very fun. If you want a more specific research-driven answer, I just got back from Alaska 2 weeks ago. I was there for a week and a half, maybe closer to 2 weeks. It felt like a very long time to be there because although it was stunningly beautiful and I got to see some really cool things that I was very overexcited for, I got very little sleep the whole time. So that was for that eelgrass project.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at wasting disease affecting the beds of eelgrass all up and down the coast right now. And that means we have to follow the tidal cycles very, very closely, since we need these intertidal beds to be as exposed as possible. So that meant the alarm went off. I think the first morning was 3:30. The second morning was also 3:30. The third morning was 2:45. I didn't understand how the tides were getting later in the day, but we kept waking up earlier. And so those were some long days.
Yeah.
Very long days. But it was a great field and lab team there. So at least good company.
Yeah. So I do not know a lot about eelgrass. Is that this isn't the right terminology, but like the foundation of an ecosystem? Like, is that what fish or invertebrates are eating on and then they're goes from there, or does it provide cover? Or what is eelgrass important for?
Grass beds in general provide a habitat structure for juveniles, fish especially, who are more susceptible to becoming prey.
Mm-hmm.
And they also decrease wave action as waves near the coast.
Mm-hmm.
This is not a particularly exposed area for most of the sites that we're looking at, but we do see a lot of fish come up into the eelgrass beds as soon as the tide comes in. So we know that that's an important structure for them.
Cool.
Yeah. Also, the eelgrass wasting disease attacking these beds right now actually occurred on the East Coast eelgrass beds in around the 70s and 80s, I believe. And that just decimated them. They're just now starting to recover, in part due to a team of scientists or one scientist in particular, actually, who went out to try and seed the grass, actually. Wow. And it was fairly successful. And so it's starting to come back now. But since it's happening on the West Coast, we're trying to get ahead of it this time. We're trying to understand what's going on. How is this related to the animals in the area? And that includes fish swimming through. So we've added an eDNA component to this. That includes the epifaunal invertebrates, which are all my samples consist of, basically. Yeah. And so I taxonomically identify all of the epifaunal invertebrates from all of the sites except for one, which is overwhelming to say the
Yeah.
least. But we think that there might be an important link between them and their grazing behavior and this wasting disease. We're not sure which direction that goes, whether it is the bite marks leave the grass blades more susceptible to disease, or if the disease makes the grass blades tastier to an epifaunal invert.
That's so interesting. Very cool. So how long is that project running for?
So it's a 3-year project. We are in the final year right now, and I think just about all of that field work has wrapped up or will in the next couple of weeks. So I am experiencing quite the influx of samples
Yeah.
and am not finding the time when that's going to happen.
Yeah, very cool. Can you, this is a horrible way to phrase this, can you do a quick-ish summary of your Chesapeake Bay work as well?
Yeah, just like field work, you mean?
Yeah.
Just about all of my field work at CERC in the Chesapeake Bay is through the Fisheries Conservation Lab. We are doing a lot of long-term monitoring because we know it's key to understanding how marine ecosystems are responding to impacts of humans. And since we know fishing and climate change are the two biggest impacts humans have had on the oceans, those are exactly what we are trying to investigate. So some of that looks like long-term projects, really getting the temporal aspect of changes of this ecosystem here on the bay. And one example would be our benthic survey. I think it started in 1979 and it has been going on. It happens quarterly. We go out and we take cores of the substrate at different sites in the Road River where CERC is located, just off the mouth of the bay. And we actually just this year added in an eDNA component to that to compare what we're finding as far as benthic infauna and meiofauna versus what's swimming around in the water and can be detected by eDNA. Mm-hmm. So that is a protocol in progress, but we're excited to see if we can find some good connections there.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, the seining project has also been going on for a long time, as has our trawling project. And the seines happen during the summer at a lot of different sites around our area in the Road River primarily. And trawls happen all along the Road River. Both of these are just to see what we're getting for trawls at different times of year and over the years. For seines, as I said, just in the summer, but that's been going on for a long time. So those are over the years as well. And to just track and monitor any changes in fish community we're seeing in sizes.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Like an example of that is with the seines this year that we have caught 3 snakeheads, which are an invasive fish
Whoa.
Species in the Chesapeake Bay. And they have reached a population size where they are no longer required to be killed when they come up. They are
oh, no.
really coming in hot. And I think it would be very cool to do something with them and to kind of track that.
Yeah.
Because that has been slowly creeping in over the past few years, but to get 3 just this summer, and we got 1 last summer, and so did another lab got it, another one last summer as well, but it definitely is increasing. So
yeah.
Stuff like that is telling us, of course, a lot about how things are changing, and would be very interesting to investigate why they're changing like that, how that got here. You know, why it's staying? Why does it like it? Is it
yeah.
warmer? Is it saltier? I don't know.
Yeah, for sure. Do you get to help direct some of your research projects that you work on, or is it mainly your PIs kind of direct most of that part?
As a tech, I generally just help out with projects.
Mm-hmm.
Our PI definitely gives us the opportunity to suggest alterations to projects, to suggest new projects altogether. We're all, I think, all as a lab involved in a recent proposal that was sent in. We made it to the final round of that process now, but we all were able to look it over and help edit it as it went along.
So you talked a little bit about going diving or doing some dive training in Panama. And so I know that you are a PADI dive master and you are also a U.S. Coast Guard certified captain. Can you tell me about the process for earning both of those certifications and how they benefit you in your current work?
Yeah. So to become a dive master through PADI, you, of course, have to go through all of the certifications that are building blocks for that. And that would be open water, advanced open water, rescue diver. And then you can start working on your dive master once you have all of those and you have 50 dives under your belt. So there is a, it basically goes the same way as any diving course does. There's a classroom component, a big test at the end, and then you have the confined water and the open water portions. And since you are, you know, a good diver by this point in time, at least 50 dives experience, those don't look quite like normal training for a regular certification. So you start in a pool, you start going through all of the skills that you might have learned when you were an open water student, your first dive ever even.
Yeah.
Where you just have to do them, but do them as if you're showing them to a student. So it's all very slow motion, very deliberate motions, and a lot of critiques from your instructor. So I hate doing the take the mask off skill because I wear contacts and the chlorine burns my eyes and it's this whole thing. But I don't know how many times I've had to do that before for no reason at all other than to prove that I can do it slowly. I can indicate where my hand needs to go to clear my mask, where my chin needs to move up to, all that good stuff. So once you do that, you can start helping out with classes. Once you have to test out of all of that stuff. But the dive shop I did through, you had to do it in front of two different instructors for every single skill, two different times. So they really make sure that you know what you're doing before they unleash you on a real class. And then basically you do everything a dive master would do in a class. You keep an eye on the students, especially the ones who are flight risks and will just pop right up to the surface.
Oh, no.
Michelin man. Because if I learned anything from that process, it's if you lose a diver, the first place you should look is up.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they like to shoot right to the surface. So you do many open water classes assisting, and then you move on, or you do many confined water classes, and then you can move on to the open water component, just like any other course, like I said. And that is where it got even sketchier because, you know, you've got a lot of people, in my case, unfortunately, it's a quarry or a lake are your options where I've done my dive master in DC. And so you either go to Virginia or to Pennsylvania. The visibility is not very good. The temperatures are often very, very sad for somebody like me who gets very cold. But once you help out with enough of those classes, you are good to go and you'll get a sign off.
That's awesome. Do you get to dive a lot for your current work?
I do dive a good bit for work. Right now, in particular, we have an oyster restoration project going on, and that has required a good bit of diving over the past couple of years and will get me diving a ton in September. It looks like we're going down and measuring density of oyster beds, I believe, collecting some live oysters to measure them. Oh, I can talk about my captain's license also.
Yeah, definitely.
I'm also U.S. Coast Guard Merchant Mariner. I got that license at the end of 2020. So it's still fairly new, very exciting. Looks like a little passport, but it's red and it has the Coast Guard emblem on the front. My picture's awful, before you ask. Horrible, just horrendous. It does get you TSA pre-check.
Oh, so that's exciting.
Real prime. Basically, the process to become a captain requires that you do a lot of studying and have sufficient experience on a boat. So you need 360 days of documented time on boats to qualify to get your captain's license. You also need to do a pretty intensive physical. You need to go to a TSA place and get your transportation workers international credential or your TWIC card. And the classroom portion is definitely the most challenging. If I remember correctly, you have to take 5 different exams. They're very challenging. And the percentages you have to get in order to pass are different for each section, but I believe they're all 80 or above percentage wise. Mm-hmm. And one of them I think is 95% or something like that. It was very intimidating.
Yeah.
Thankfully my Vanderbilt study skills came in handy and it wasn't too bad, But I did take week-long course, 8 or 9 hours a day, just in a room full of men. So I was the only woman in, I think, a 17 or 18 person class.
Oh, wow.
To get this license.
So what inspired you to get that license?
I have wanted it for a long time. I always thought it would be really, really cool. And I was actually really close to doing the course and the practical for the Yacht Master, mm-hmm. which is an international sailing captain certification. Right after my time on Seamaster, I was very close to doing that. But it's expensive, and mm-hmm. it is specifically for people who want to be extremely good at what they do recreationally, or who carry passengers who pay them on board. So the Yacht Master is more for an international captain's license. It's respected worldwide. Mm. And if anyone questions your skill, that's a great thing to show. Whereas the Merchant Mariner license does the same thing, but is not recognized worldwide. It is a United States thing. Mm-hmm. And it is for, most people get it because they have boat-based businesses. So if you're carrying paying passengers on board, you're required to have it.
Okay.
That is not the case with me, but I did want the knowledge. I wanted to have that under my belt. Should I, just for professional development, should I choose to do something in ecotourism or something like that in the future? That would help me get into that more easily and be very qualified for it.
Yeah, very cool. I just thought that was really interesting because I think you're one of the only people I know with that license. So I want to make sure we touched on that. One of the other things I wanted to touch on was your science communication skills. I obviously follow you on Instagram because we're friends, but I also really enjoy it because you do a great job of communicating your work. And also you sent me your resume, which is an ArcGIS story map. And I feel like everyone should have a resume like that because it's so fun to read through. So I was just wondering, why do you find science communication to be so important? And do you have any tips for other scientists on communicating their work?
I think science communication is literally the most important thing we as scientists can do. If only the scientific community cares about this stuff, the Earth will go down in a burning ball of fire very soon. If we can get other people to care about this stuff, then we can have more trees and fewer emissions and so many good productive things. But we can't do that with only a very small subset. Of the global community.
Do you have any tips or advice?
The best advice I could give for science communication is be engaging and try and have the right mix of fun and interesting things with serious and impactful topics. No one wants to look at a feed of doomsday and how terrible things are right now, even if that is the case. But those are important things to bring to people's attention, to announce the severity of ocean acidification or something. And not just that, but to make people care about it, to make it personal, to share some beautiful photos or videos of fish and some fun facts that make people want to see them themselves. But then also don't forget to mention that they're in danger and we can actually do something, but we have to work together and we have to work quickly.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. That was great. Okay, this one should be more fun. This is a question I always want to ask people because I struggle with only focusing on my work and on conservation and science in general. And I'm trying to be better about doing other hobbies. So what hobbies and interests do you have outside of science and conservation?
The first thing that comes to mind for me is definitely running. Mm-hmm. I love to run. I am one of the few very crazy people that truly, truly loves to run. So I spend a lot of my free time doing that, especially if I have a race coming up. I'm probably doing 35 miles a week right now in preparation for a marathon this fall. And I would love to do some more ultra races like I've done previously. I've done a 50K and a 50 miler, both in trails in the Maryland area. And I'm really hoping, because it is a bit of an ultra runner's rite of passage, to do a Grand Canyon rim to rim.
Nice.
Or potentially a rim to rim to rim.
Oh my God.
Which would be so cool. And I would need a big team to come support me. But I think I can make it happen. If not in the next couple of years, then at some point.
Yeah. Is that marathon you're training for, the Boston Marathon?
Yes, I'm running the Boston Marathon.
Okay, I was like, I feel like she's playing this down a little bit. That's awesome.
I'm very excited. It'll be my first Boston.
Very cool. All right. So called TEF part of the interview is over, and we are down to our final few questions that we ask each of the guests that come on the show. The first one is one of my favorite questions. What is your favorite fish?
So this is a very hard question for me. I've been thinking about this the entire time too. Okay. Can I give you two?
Yeah, I'm good with it.
Is that illegal? Well, one's not technically a fish. Yeah, so
I'll accept it.
So a lot of listeners have probably held a coastal fish identification book at some point in their life. You can imagine the black book and the beautiful picture in the front, and it tells you the region up top. Well, there is one, I believe in the Caribbean version of this book, that I don't even know if it shows a mature adult. It just shows, I think, a juvenile. And it is my favorite fish in the entire book, although I do have a soft spot for the odd-shaped bottom dweller section because that's just hysterically funny to me for some reason. I love juvenile yellow boxfish. I think they are the cutest things you've ever seen. They're like the size, I don't even know. I think the description literally says about the size of a pea. That is how their size is described. They are tiny little pencil eraser fellows, bright yellow with polka dots, and they're so cute. I just love them. They also look really angry all the time, but I don't care. They're so cute. I just love them so much. Mm-hmm. Not all of them look angry, but some of them really do.
That's their charm.
And I have to give a bonus fish that's not a fish, but it has fish in the name because I am really, really in love with cuttlefish. They are technically mollusks, but super cool. Super cool. So many fun facts.
That's so awesome.
You don't have to include that, but I really love cuttlefish.
I probably will because I loved it.
I will. If I ever have to run on a treadmill, I will pop onto YouTube and search cuttlefish documentary, and that's what I will watch the entire time.
Oh my God.
That is the only way a treadmill run
that's
is
amazing.
Bearable. I'm not lying to you. Like, this is the weirdest girl this podcast has ever interviewed.
I love this. Okay, next question is, what is your favorite memory from your career so far?
You want type one fun or type two? Because I have a lot more type two that are coming to mind.
You can do type two.
One that comes to mind is the day we went to Ocean City, Maryland to do some shark tagging. And I love sharks maybe as much as cuttlefish.
Yeah.
But they are really cool and really exciting. And I would love to do more work with them in the future. But we went out and we caught some duskies and some sandbar sharks and tagged them for tracking purposes. And that was really fun. Just a good team out there and a good number of sharks, which definitely did not always happen on those trips. So it was a very successful day and I got to help sew up some sharks and touch a lot of them. It was very exciting.
That is so cool.
Yeah, our shark postdoc has left us for Canada for some reason, but we don't have any shark projects now, so it's sad. One of my favorite type two fun kind of days that I think absolutely no one else is going to agree with me on, no one else in my lab will concur here, but it ironically happened exactly a year ago today, because one of my lab mates actually just texted me a photo from that day. It is a photo of our trawl net, which is a large net full and hanging over the stern deck of our boat, just chock full, oozing with jellyfish tentacles.
Oh no.
It's so full, you can't see a single fish in there. It's only jellyfish. And that thing weighed, I think, twice what I do. It was so full. And so we all had stings all over every exposed inch of our bodies. We had stings in our eyes. We had stings on our lips, stings literally on our tongue. If you open your mouth wrong at the wrong second, because you would have to put these jellyfish along with the few fish that were being suffocated by them into a bin to measure and count them and keep them alive to quickly toss them back overboard. But the faster you're doing things and the more fish you have, the more they're flapping around and just flicking the stinging cells straight up into your face. And it didn't matter if you had sunglasses on or anything. And so we were all just at our wits' end. It was during a summer flounder project where we were doing 20 trawls a day and sometimes having to travel to these sites. And so they made for extremely long days. And I just remember that day, everyone wasn't talking to each other towards the end. We pulled up to a dock in a marina to get gas. And the guy there had popsicles. Those kind that were just sugar, frozen ice that'll cut the sides of your mouth up if you get them at the wrong angle. But he gave us popsicles while we were getting gas. And really, that made it so much better. It was just really what we needed at that time. So I look back fondly on that day. I would not want to relive it.
No.
It was also like 100 degrees outside. Yeah. And I don't think we had cover on the boat.
Oh my God.
A lot of type two right there.
Firmly type two fun right there.
Yeah. What a day.
Oh my goodness. Well, I'm so happy I have you on this podcast. They're such good stories.
I'm happy to be here.
All right. Our next question is, what is your dream job or location?
I think I could go a couple directions and be very happy with either. I think either I could go the ecotourism route, use my captain's license, my dive master, and perhaps up that to an instructor certification, and be a marine biologist on board a tours boat, whether that's dive tours or shark tours or something like that, that would get people out on the water. I really, really firmly believe that if people don't experience things firsthand, they are never going to get it or care that much, because you can watch a million of Paul Nicklin's videos and look at his photos and see every David Attenborough narrated documentary film that exists, but despite, you know, whatever 4K, 5K video they have these days, it's never going to be the real thing until you're there. And so I think that that is in part why I wanted to get a professional dive certification, just because it's so exciting to see people get so excited.
Yeah.
Almost as excited as I am about being in the water and being underwater and feeling like a fish. But I think that everyone needs to see that firsthand. So it would be really rewarding doing that angle. Although there's a customer service component and you never know what you're going to get. I could also stay in research, academia. If I went the other direction and stayed in research, though, I would really want to be some more coastal. And that goes for both of these. The Chesapeake Bay has a lot of interesting areas to it, a lot of potential for study and restoration, but it's not the ocean. And the ocean is really where my heart is. So I need to go somewhere that is on the coast. I would love to be somewhere that is warm, somewhere that has water. I can see my hand in front of my face in when I am diving, because I do not have that luxury in the bay right now. And I think I would really love to figure out how to move to Australia. Honestly, I want to go there. I would love to do research there. I could also do ecotourism career there. So who knows? But I am hoping that at some point all that can happen.
If money was not an issue, what is one project you would like to work on?
If I was doing this project from CERC, I would definitely want to start back up the shark tagging program that a previous postdoc was leading. That was very fun to be a part of. Very interesting. I would love to learn more about sharks, be more involved in that research, especially considering how important they are to ecosystem everywhere. And that would mean a bit of travel for us to get to the ocean. But I think that if money was no issue, yeah, we could be flying all over the world and looking at sharks. So that is, I think, definitely what I'd want to do, because there could be local components, so it'd be reasonable. But there could also be some international components that would be awesome.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, our last question of the interview. If there was one pointer principle that you could have programmed into everyone's head, what would it be?
I would say try and love other people really well. They're not going to listen to you if you don't like them or they don't like you. So love other people well and you'll have better conversations.
That is
about stuff you care about.
Carmen, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. It was so great hearing about you and all of your work. If people want to find more information or get a hold of you, how would they do that?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at @ocean_critter. And that's about it, because social media is kind of scary.
Yeah, that's perfect. If you'd like to get a hold of me or the podcast, you can find me at KB Heinle on Twitter. And the podcast is on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Fisheries Pod, or you can send an email to feedback@thefisheriespodcast.com. I hope that you enjoyed this episode. You can download past, present, and future episodes on your favorite listening app, or stream it from Spotify or thefisheriespodcast.com. And don't forget, you can help support the podcast with a monthly contribution through Patreon or by rocking some awesome Fisheries Podcast shirts, hoodies, and stickers available on Teespring. I'm Katie Heinle. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Fisheries Podcast. And remember, love other people well and you'll have better conversations.